This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Wednesday, May 8th, 2013, I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. One of four proposed coal export terminals in the Pacific Northwest has been canceled following a similar cancellation last month of a proposed terminal in Coos Bay. Just two proposals remain of the original four, with environmental groups and local residents vowing to continue the fight until all the proposals are canceled. Texas-based terminal builder Kinder Morgan announced today that it will not go forward with plans to build a terminal at the Port of St. Helens. Kinder Morgan is one of the nation's largest transporters of petroleum products. They currently operate terminals in Portland, Vancouver, and Longview, and also manage a 100-mile pipeline from the Columbia River to Eugene. The canceled terminal would have exported up to 30 million tons of coal per year from the Powder River Basin in Montana to Asia. The facility was strongly contested by environmentalists and also drew opposition from PGE due to concerns of coal dust interfering with its equipment. A Kinder Morgan spokesperson cited logistics difficulties as the reason for dropping the plan to build the terminal. Port Westward was one of three locations proposed by Kinder Morgan, leaving locations in Longview, Washington, and Boardman, Oregon, still under consideration. This is on the heels of financial backers dropping out of a proposal for another coal export facility in Coos Bay last month.
The Oregon House of Representatives today passed a bill to protect domestic workers from abuses by their employers. Under the new bill, nannies, housekeepers, and in-home cooks will receive overtime pay, 8 hours to rest, and meal breaks during the day. Many domestic workers are immigrants, and some face abusive employers who take away their passports or forbid them from speaking their native language. In Oregon, an estimated 10,000 domestic workers are employed by households around the state. Most of the Republicans in the Oregon State House opposed the bill, saying that the wording was overly broad. Republican Bill Kenemer from Oregon City said that he believes the bill in its current form is, quote, not ready for prime time. But domestic workers who testified in favor of the bill cheered its passage, saying that the abuses they have faced while working in Oregon homes should become a thing of the past. The bill passed this morning by a slim majority and will now move to the Oregon Senate for approval.
Fluoridation has lit a fire under many citizens as Portland voters decide whether or not to put the chemical in the water supply this month. Craig Mossbeek, a public health consultant in favor of fluoride, found his pro-fluoride sign torched on Saturday morning. Police spokesman Sergeant Pete Simpson said this is the first recorded case of sign vandalism he's heard of. Mossbeek's daughter Ellie spoke before city council this morning.
I'm happy to have straight and healthy teeth because people notice your teeth, and bad teeth can stay with you for the rest of your life. But in Portland, we are not currently fluoridating the water, which would help protect everyone's teeth. The cost of water fluoridation is less than a dollar for each person per year. I grew up here, and by age 5, I had 6 cavities and needed a baby root canal. Even now, 10 years later, I still remember the pain and how uncomfortable it felt. It's truly awful. No kid should have to go through that. I appreciate this opportunity to talk to you about water fluoridation. This is how we should talk about and debate these issues. However, over the weekend, the pro-fluoride sign in our front yard was set on fire. If we can prevent people from rotting teeth, tooth loss, pain, and suffering, as a community, if we can bring that sort of happiness to someone, let's do it.
And that was Ellie Mossbeek speaking at the City Council's morning session. Clean Water Portland, an organization fighting fluoridation, points to the potential dangers of adding fertilizer byproduct fluorosilic acid to the water.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales plans on drastically cutting the city's budget for the upcoming fiscal year, including many fire and police department jobs. The Main Street program, run by the Portland Development Commission, will also face significant cuts. Main Street's mission is to bolster economic development in the Alberta, St. John's, and Hillsdale neighborhoods. Angela Heine owns Frock, a Main Street participant in Alberta, and spoke before City Council this morning.
I have firsthand knowledge of everything that we've accomplished, and I have a very big stake in our neighborhood. I'm very vested in our neighborhood, and I think the city of Portland needs to be as well. We need your support to continue with the successes that we've had, and we'd hate to have the rug ripped out from under us. The things we've been able to build in the last couple of years without the funding from the city, it may all be for naught. So I just want to urge you to continue to fund the Main Street programs, not only on Alberta Street, but also Hillsdale and St. John's. We have had some stakeholders in our community, you know, modest stakeholder involvement, and we want our community to help fund us, but we can't expect that to happen overnight. So we'd hate to see the city's $58,000 investment go away. That's about 35% of our annual budget. It accounts for 50% of our executive director's salary, and a district improvement grant that has leveraged three times its value in private reinvestment. Losing such significant funding with no time to prepare would likely signal the end of a very successful program. It would be especially detrimental to the diversity in our community. We have over 45 minority-owned businesses, 39 minority-owned commercial properties. One thing that makes the Main Street program in general so unique is that we serve and support everyone in a district, whether or not they have the funds to contribute. Private investment, we don't feel is a viable option for us at this point. We're too young. I have a thriving business on Alberta Street that I've had for 10 years. We're thriving because we've been there for 10 years. I just urge you to keep the funding in place or reinstate the funding for the Main Street program. It's an incredible program that is across the country.
That was Angela Heine addressing the City Council today.
Mayor Charlie Hales announced Tuesday that residents who receive Social Security income will be exempt from the city's $35 art tax, contrary to previous statements. City Council voted last month that residents who earn an annual income of less than $1,000 are also exempt from the arts tax. Mayor Hales' spokesperson, Dana Haynes, stated that city's position is the same, but the revision came about due to misunderstandings of how the tax bill was written. Mayor Haynes consulted City Attorney Jim Van Dyke about Social Security income being taxable. Van Dyke stated that the issue had not arisen until the tax had already been voted on. The city said that individuals who earn income through Social Security, or PERS, are not to be taxed. Individuals who have earned income through Social Security and Public Employee Retirement System income will be eligible for a refund on their arts tax.
In local labor news, University of Oregon professors were on the picket line yesterday to demand a fair contract for their newly formed 1,800-member union. The professors criticized the university president for his $500,000 salary and called on the university to maintain their retirement benefits if they are cut by the state legislature. In other union news, precision cast parts workers will vote in June on whether to unionize. The 2,300 workers at facilities in Portland, Clackamas, and Milwaukee began to organize because of impossible production goals, extended overtime, and penalties for taking sick days. Precision Cast Parts Management opposes unionization, but has spent billions of dollars over the last several years to acquire smaller companies in the aerospace and industrial component manufacturing industry. The proposal for unionization at KBOO Community Radio has been accepted by management, where nine employees will form the newest local chapter of the Communication Workers of America. And finally, a group of workers at the University Place Hotel, run by Portland State University, have accused management of cronyism, extortion, and mismanagement. Although the university denies the claims, they fired the general manager and assistant yesterday. One employee of the university-owned hotel says that he was forced to clean the home of university president Vim Vivel, and another reported having to pay kickbacks to his supervisor in order to get hired.
This Saturday, donating food to a hungry family in Oregon is as easy as putting a bag on non-perishable food on your front porch near the mailbox. The goal for this year's Stamp Out Hunger Drive in Oregon is 1.5 million pounds. In collaboration with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Audrey Davis has more on the story.
Stamp Out Hunger is the largest annual canned food drive in Oregon and the nation, and it's this Saturday, May 11th. It's also one of the busiest days of the year for letter carriers, who pick up all that food as they deliver the mail on their routes. 4,000 of them in Oregon will be assisted by a small army of volunteers who will collect and sort the food as it's brought back to the local post offices. Susanna Morgan at the Oregon Food Bank says it keeps local food banks stocked through the summer, and it's just as important for the local postal workers.
I have heard from many letter carriers through the years that this is an extremely meaningful day for them, a way that connects their day-to-day work in the community, has a chance to be able to return some benefits to folks they see that are struggling on their routes.
Morgan says the need is still high statewide for emergency food boxes. The goal of this year's Stamp Out Hunger Drive in Oregon is 1.5 million pounds of food. That's up from 1.3 million last year. Letter carriers are delivering reminder postcards or bags for the food this week. The U.S. Postal Service has had its share of hard times lately, with plans still being debated to close some rural post offices and distribution centers and end Saturday mail delivery. But Jerry Fitzsimmons with the National Association of Letter Carriers in Portland says the food drive won't be affected, and for now, it's the business as usual for the Postal Service.
You know, the service part of it needs to expand, not be cut back. Service companies don't do well when they cut service. They do better when they add service. We're working hard to make sure that we preserve Saturday delivery. On top of that, that means we preserve the food drive on Saturday as well.
If for any reason you missed the May 11th food pickup in your neighborhood, food donations can be dropped off at any post office by Wednesday, May 15th. For KBOO News, this is Audrey Davis.
Today, in an audit made by Oregon Secretary of State Kate Brown, hundreds of Oregonians have received public assistance that were not eligible. These people include lottery winners, incarcerated and deceased residents, and retired public employees. Examples include about 1,000 residents who share the same Social Security number with the deceased. According to the report, lottery winners who have won up to $900,000 are still receiving social service benefits. Lottery winnings are not considered income, according to some eligibility and reporting methods. Over 1,300 public employee retirees who receive lump sum retirement pensions have been receiving Medicaid. One specific individual received benefits for 16 months after being paid close to $400,000 in lump sum retirement pay. Over 150 inmates have received an accumulative $300,000. The audit suggests that Oregon legislature secure eligibility of benefits by having the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority verify Social Security numbers more accurately. And the legislature also suggests that the two public service agencies recover the overcompensations through collection agency, including prosecution.
This coming Saturday, gun control advocacy group Ceasefire Oregon will hold a gun buyback at the Linwood Friends Church in southeast Portland. The returns will be no questions asked, and Fred Meyer gift certificates will be provided in varying sizes depending upon the type of gun turned in. A handgun will get a $100 card, an assault rifle, $175. Rifles and shotguns get $75. High-capacity magazines get $25 each, and $10 certificates will be given for each BB or pellet gun turned in. This past Monday, representatives of Ceasefire Oregon, as well as Police Chief Mike Reese, County Commissioner Deborah Kafuri, and City Commissioner Mike Novick met at county headquarters to promote the event. The gun buyback will be held from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. this Saturday. Linwood Friends Church is located at 835 Southeast 162nd Street.
An anonymous communique sent to KGW News in Portland this morning claimed responsibility for smashing several windows at the Nike factory store in Northeast Portland late last night. The activist said that the action was meant to challenge the corporatization of the gay, lesbian, and transgender movement by the sponsorship of companies like Nike. The international shoe company, based in Beaverton, is a major sponsor of the annual Gay Pride Parade in Portland. For the last 2 years, Nike has driven a military-style all-terrain vehicle as its float in the parade. In the communique, the activist stated that Nike claims to invest in community while maintaining sweatshops employing what they term modern slaves. They said that last night's window smashing was taken in memory of three trans women of color who were murdered last month, Kelly Young, Ashley Sinclair, and Cece Dove. In addition, the activists said they were acting in solidarity with those resisting the grand jury that is currently targeting anarchists in Seattle.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Right to Survive at 6, confronting the housing crisis and organizing housing activists to address systemic inequalities. At 7 o'clock, it's a live broadcast of Final Talk of the Illahi Lecture Series. Tonight, hear Jeffrey Clements, author of the book Corporations Are Not People. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly cloudy in the morning and sunny in the afternoon with high temperatures near 77 degrees.
It's 5:19 in the post-meridian. Time for daily comedy commentary from Jim Hightower.
Hide and seek can be a fun game for kids, but when huge corporations play it in our elections, fun becomes infuriating. Last year, corporate interests sought to elect their candidates by hiding from voters. In all, $352 million in dark money was spent, the bulk of it by corporations that secretly pumped it into trade associations, social welfare charities, and other front groups run by the likes of Karl Rove, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and the Koch brothers. Since surreptitious electioneering puts a fatal curse on democracy, there's now a push in the Securities and Exchange Commission for a rule requiring corporate executives to reveal to their owners, i.e. their shareholders, any political donations they make with company money. How sensible. But this simple proposal has caused a fury among those who profit by playing political hide-and-seek from voters. CEOs of the 200 largest corporations are being rallied to the barricades to stop it, and House Republicans are even trying to make it illegal for the SEC to let shareholders and the voting public know which campaigns are being backed by cash from which corporations. Their rabid panic over a little sunlight reveals just how powerful dark money is. Ironically, the Supreme Court's chief assumption in allowing unlimited corporate cash into our democratic process was that shareholders would be informed, involved, and provide public accountability for their company's political spending. This is Jim Hightower saying, even Justice Antonin Scalia, a cheerleader for corporate politicking, is no fan of hiding one's electioneering efforts from voters. Requiring people to stand up in public for their political acts fosters civic courage, he says. A campaign hidden from public scrutiny, Scalia writes, is anathema to self-governance. He adds that campaigning anonymously, quote, does not resemble the home of the brave.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A new report from the Center for Housing Policy using U.S. Census data found that renters across the country are paying more for housing as their incomes are declining. This has led to a situation where many households are paying up to half of their income in rent. For more, KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with Janet Rivars with the National Center for Housing Policy about the report.
The report suggests that renters are facing what you deem a severe housing cost burden.
Yes. In 2011, we found that a quarter of working renter households were spending more than half of their paycheck on their housing. Like working renter households, working owner households have also seen their income decrease between 2008 and 2011. But at the same time, their incomes were falling, so were their housing costs. And there are a lot of reasons for this. It could be because households are refinancing at lower interest rates. It could be because they've moved to different households and homes that fit within their budget. But for the most part, 2011 and 2008, the share of households who spent more than half their income is the same. There was a very slight increase, and then it did fall again. But for the most part, it's held fairly steady.
Hard not to notice the language of home ownership crisis. Can you tell me how that phrase came to be and what it means?
what seemed like a doable proposition several years ago before the recession in terms of buying a home, maybe at an adjustable rate mortgage that you plan to refinance later, or a house that you could afford with your income, assuming that it wasn't going to drop. These were all factors that went on in terms of people's decisions to buying a home. And then with the housing market crash, it really forced a lot of households into positions where their paychecks were cut and they could no longer afford their mortgage payments, or the interest rates on their mortgage reset to extremely high levels. And so the crisis, to my mind, it indicates that this is a widespread problem across the nation for households that are no longer able to afford the homes that they purchased for a variety of reasons. And a lot of people have had to leave their homes, and many other people have held off on purchasing homes.
That was Janet Rivaros with the National Center for Housing Policy, speaking about the group's new report on the increasing costs of housing both for renters and owners.
Yesterday, a coalition of progressive grassroots nonprofit organizations formed to drop advertisements on Facebook in response to the agenda of Mark Zuckerberg's newly founded political organization, FWD.US. FWD.US supports the drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and building of the Keystone XL pipeline, has opposed health care reform at the same time they claim to support immigration reform. KBOO's Sean Stewart has more on this with Credo's Becky Bond.
Progressive groups have dropped advertising on Facebook this week to send a message to Mark Zuckerberg and the Facebook community. Mark Zuckerberg is getting involved in politics, and he's doing some very bad things. He's airing pro-Keystone XL propaganda. He's praising senators who are denying climate change. And we need to send a message to him that if he's going to get involved in politics and work against our interests, then we're not going to be supporting Facebook. And he needs to understand that the political stance he takes will have an impact on the business that made his fortune.
What other modes of action do you feel are needed to effectively stop Zuckerberg's campaign?
Zuckerberg is very sensitive to public pressure. His company went public last year, and when he takes actions that hurt Facebook, it's not something that he can just decide to do unilaterally, because he's responsible to the board of Facebook, to the shareholders of Facebook, and to the people who work at Facebook every day. And so when Mark Zuckerberg does something like, because his stand on Keystone XL and climate are unpopular, he can't just refuse our paid advertising on the site that calls attention to his private political actions. What we're doing is we're spreading the word, and we're using Mark Zuckerberg's social network site, Facebook, to do it. We're using shareable Facebook graphics. We're using Facebook posts. We try to use Facebook advertising until they stopped us, but we're also getting tens of thousands of people to sign petitions by email, which we've delivered to his headquarters in Palo Alto. And finally, this message has really taken off. This story has really taken off in the press. And so you have everything from the Washington Post to KBOO, which is telling the story of Mark Zuckerberg trying to push his political agenda funded by Facebook dollars to the public, and we're not buying it. And if enough Facebook users and enough the general public push back and create enough of a backlash, Mark Zuckerberg will have to stop his anti-climate propaganda.
How long do you think it will take before we are able to reverse the pipeline propaganda?
Most people thought this pipeline would have been built by now, but at every turn, from the First Nations people in Canada stopping the pipeline from going out to Canada's west coast, to the movement in 2011 to stop the president from approving the pipeline when he was running for president in 2011 and 2012, until today, every time they try and get this pipeline approved, we're there pushing back to make sure that it doesn't. This pipeline will spell game over for the climate, and for those of us who see this as the challenge of our generation, this is a fight that we can't lose. And so we'll have to fight every day. And even if the president rejects Keystone XL pipeline, they'll keep coming back and we'll have to keep fighting. So this is a fight where we cannot let up, where we cannot stop. And every victory is temporary.
And this is Sean Stewart with KBOO News.
Today, the House passed the so-called Working Families Flexibility Act proposed by the Republican Party. The bill is opposed to labor unions and workers' rights groups as it allows employers to substitute compensatory time off for monetary overtime wages. Instead of receiving additional wages at overtime rates, workers could take off an hour and a half for every overtime hour they work. But there's no guarantee that the employer would provide the comp time, and workers may simply be forced to work overtime with no compensation at all. Supporters of the bill argue that it would give employees more flexibility and allow them to spend more time with their families. However, many strongly oppose the bill, and President Obama has threatened to veto it. The National Partnership for Women and Families also released a statement in opposition to the bill. They argue that the bill would only offer more flexibility to employers who could deny a worker's request to use compensatory time if it unduly disrupts operations. Opponents also argue that it could hurt job creation by giving incentives for employers to hire fewer workers and rely on comp time to cut costs.
A report released this week by Save the Children found that the United States is number one among developed nations in its rate of infant mortality in the first day of life. Over 1 million babies die around the world each year on the first day they're born. In the U.S., over 11,000 babies a year die on the first day of life, putting us behind many Eastern European countries, and 60th worldwide in day one infant mortality. Many of these deaths are preventable, with products costing less than $6 apiece. These include breathing devices to help babies with their first breath, antibiotics, and antiseptics to reduce infections. The report also recommended exclusive breastfeeding and keeping preterm babies warm against their mother's skin.
The Institute for Democracy and Justice in Haiti is threatening to sue the United Nations for the outbreak of cholera that began there in October of 2010. So far, 500,000 people have been infected in the epidemic, and nearly 8,000 people have died. According to the Institute for Democracy and Justice, UN peacekeepers brought the illness to Haiti after contracting it in Nepal, where cholera is a persistent problem. Cholera-infected waste from the peacekeeping team got into one of Haiti's major rivers because of inadequate sterilization and spread throughout the island. Haiti was already hard hit from the earthquake in January 2010, leaving many internally displaced people without access to proper water, medical care, or sanitation. The Institute is seeking $50,000 for each cholera survivor and $100,000 for each family with a deceased member. 8,000 people have already signed on to the class action suit. The United Nations is taking some action with regards to cholera in Haiti. In December of last year, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon began a $2 billion initiative to fight cholera there. But the Institute says that this is not enough, and the UN must take responsibility for its role in the cholera epidemic in Haiti.
There have been record low levels of internet use between Syria and the West, indicating that Syria's internet connection has been severed. Google and Renesis have both reported that their connections with Syria have been discontinued, and according to Dan Hubbard of Umbrella Security Labs, Syria's top two servers have both been down today. Internet blackouts have occurred before in Syria, most notably in November of 2012. Most Western news correspondents have not been allowed to report from Syria since the beginning of the Syrian uprising in March 2011. This current blackout leaves details of the Syrian conflict even more scarce. Although the internet in Syria is heavily censored, this current lack of web access also severely further endangers the lives of Syrian citizens, who use it as a vital communication tool as the country becomes increasingly dangerous. The humanitarian crisis in Syria continues to escalate, with refugees fleeing to surrounding countries and almost 60,000 recorded deaths between March 2011 and November 2012.
Violence is spreading in Pakistan as the country prepares for general elections on May 11th. Pakistan is experiencing its first transition from one democratically elected prime minister to another. The elections have caused backlash, mostly from political factions that do not support democracy at all, including the Pakistani Taliban. During a political rally for the Awami Nationalist Party on Wednesday, two people were killed and 27 injured by an explosion in the federally administered tribal areas of northwestern Pakistan. Attacks have been occurring at night because rallies are held after dark to attract a greater turnout. Also on Wednesday, a suicide bomber killed a policeman and two women in Banu by strapping explosives to a car. In another northern Pakistani city, Hangu, a bomb went off in a vegetable cart, wounding 14 people.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, four Afghan policemen were killed and one injured in a roadside bomb explosion yesterday. Although no group has taken responsibility for the attack, Afghan officials have blamed Taliban troops. A UN report published Monday found that about 10% of Afghanistan's gross domestic product depends on opium. That percentage is down from 15% in 2011. The value of opium products in the country was estimated at nearly $2 billion last year. Afghanistan produces 90% of the world's opiates.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, May 8, 2013. Israeli troops invade West Bank communities, arrest civilians, and demolish two homes. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. On Wednesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded the northern West Bank district of Nablus and kidnapped nine Palestinians. The soldiers also fired several rounds of live ammunition into the air, broke into and searched homes, and confiscated property. Local sources in Nablus city reported that dozens of Israeli military jeeps invaded several neighborhoods in the city and kidnapped three Palestinians after breaking into and searching their homes. Furthermore, the army invaded Beit Furik town east of Nablus and kidnapped six Palestinians. Also Wednesday, Israeli soldiers kidnapped the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and the Holy Land, Sheikh Mohammed Husseini, after surrounding his home and breaking into it in East Jerusalem. The Mufti was moved to Al-Maskubiya police station and interrogation center. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers invaded on Wednesday morning Al-Uja village in Jericho, demolished two Palestinian homes, and handed orders to demolish five more homes in the village.